This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear from a UCSB neuroscientist about a research project aimed at understanding Alzheimer's.
Our group thought that there must be some reason why she escaped what everybody else in the family was getting. She had the mutation, and yet she was not sick.
Also, we'll take a look at how the Gala Center for Diversity has become more inclusive.
We realize that the diversity, equity, inclusion, in addition to including all kinds of sexual orientations, gender identities, and expressions, also is about disability, race, all the other things that come together to make us who we are.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, February 1st. I'm Carol Tangeman. Most of California's public school students have been in distance learning for nearly a full year, and there are still no concrete plans to reopen schools. Cap Radio's Nicole Nixon reports.
Governor Gavin Newsom had a $2 billion plan to bring younger students back to classrooms by mid-February, but the proposal appears to have stalled in the legislature. The influential California Teachers Association has resisted returning to classrooms during the pandemic. The union's president, E. Toby Boyd, says counties where the virus is considered widespread should not open schools.
Yes, the numbers are going down, and yes, the ICU beds are opening up. That's wonderful news, but we can't just jump the gun and say, okay, we're going to do this now.
CDC researchers have said there's little evidence of outbreaks in schools as long as precautions like masks are in place. But Boyd says union members still don't want to return to classrooms until they feel safe.
We need to make sure we have all the other items in place in order to mitigate the spread of the virus in the classroom, because it does occur.
This is now a matter of political will.
Megan Bacigalupi is part of a growing group of parents across the state calling for a plan to reopen schools as soon as possible. The Oakland mother of two says it's disingenuous for Newsom to say he's following the science on pandemic precautions.
You can't say follow the science and listen to Dr. Fauci and listen to the CDC when Dr. Fauci and the CDC are saying schools can be opened safely. You can't then have one slight carve out for teachers unions.
The CTA wants educators to get vaccine priority, but the state is short on supply and there are already millions of seniors waiting their turn too. In Sacramento, I'm Nicole Nixon.
Advocates say meeting farm workers at their workplace to distribute vaccines is the best way to ensure that all farm workers get the vaccine. Fresno County began its soft rollout of vaccines to farm workers last week, with 50 ag workers receiving their first shots of the COVID-19 vaccine at their workplace. KVPR's Maddie Bolaños reports.
In addition to on-site workplace vaccines, county officials say the local health department is working with rural clinics to distribute the vaccines. United Farm Worker Foundation spokeswoman Lady Rangel says that's a good start, but mobile clinics should take the place of rural clinics.
If we're talking about farm workers who live in rural areas, it might take them 30 minutes just to get to the nearest vaccination location.
For a population that relies heavily on carpooling or public transportation, it's just not feasible, Rangel says. And most clinics are only offering appointments during their work hours, which presents another obstacle for farm workers.
If they make an appointment with the public health sites, what that means, what that translates to is they're going to have to lose a whole day of work just to get the vaccine.
Rangel says counties also need to provide COVID-19 information in more languages, including indigenous dialects. I'm Maddie Bolaños.
California Governor Gavin Newsom has spent much of his political career advocating for tech innovation in government. But Newsom has had mixed success modernizing state bureaucracy in the last 2 years. Cap Radio's Scott Rodd reports.
In 2013, then-Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom went on Comedy Central's The Colbert Report to hype his new book called Citizenville: How to Take the Town Square Digital and Reinvent Government.
The whole idea is this. Right now, we have a broadcast model of governing that you vote and I decide. It's this, you understand this intimately. You've seen the contours of this change with the media. You've seen it certainly in the music industry. Big is getting small and small is getting big. Technology has the ability to level the playing field.
What the f*** does any of that mean?
The book's message is actually fairly simple. governments need to be tech savvy and should open their troves of data to the public. In turn, people will become more engaged in the civic process. But modernizing state government? That's been a challenge for Newsom in the last 2 years. Here he is a few weeks ago unveiling his latest budget proposal.
And I wrote a book about being on the leading and cutting edge of 1976 in terms of our IT. And trust me, that's been made abundantly clear to not just me, to all of you in this last year.
So I'm starting to log on to the unemployment website right now.
Mary Montgomery works at a sushi restaurant in Sacramento that has opened and closed throughout the pandemic. Like millions of Californians, she applied for unemployment insurance to help make ends meet. Then the state inexplicably froze her benefits.
It says that I have over $5,000 that I should be able to use, but there's no way for me to use that money.
The Employment Development Department's dusty old computer system has been blamed for its high-profile failures in recent months. There's an ongoing backlog of about 1 million claims, and there's rampant fraud that could total more than $30 billion. Newsom appointed a strike team that recommended a complete IT overhaul. How to do that is still unclear. So for now, the existing system limps along. During the pandemic, Newsom's administration has been more successful at tracking the virus.
It's done a good job for the population as a whole and for major racial ethnic groups.
Ninez Ponce is director of UCLA's Center for Health Policy Research. She says there have been a few hiccups, and California could do a better job at disclosing targeted population data, but its tracking system on the whole is better than most states. Newsom has also been quick to forge partnerships with Silicon Valley during the pandemic. That's according to Amy Tong, the state's chief information officer. She points to California Notify, a contact tracing app for your phone that's garnered millions of users.
That is a partnership with Google and Apple. It's an exposure notification, and we piloted it with all the UC campuses to begin with.
But for every new dashboard or widget, a decades-old server is still waiting to be replaced. Tong says the state's biggest tech challenge isn't updating those systems, but rather winning over the hearts and minds of public employees who are used to doing things a certain way.
There's a huge culture change that needs to happen to make sure the people that are running the program, people running the operations, are comfortable. Technology alone is not the panacea.
To encourage this cultural shift, Newsom created the Office of Digital Innovation shortly after taking office and allocated $40 million to get it started. One of its first projects was prototyping a redesign of the state government's website. But the homepage warns the site is still a work in progress, and some of the information may be outdated. In Sacramento, I'm Scott Rodd.
A woman from Colombia who defied odds that she would suffer early onset Alzheimer's disease recently died and left her brain to science. A team of neuroscientists at UCSB will spend the next several months studying the brain tissue in search of clues and information about the disease. Contributor Beth Thornton talked with Dr. Ken Kosick.
Dr. Kosick, please introduce yourself.
My name is Ken Kosick, and I am a professor of neuroscience at University of California, Santa Barbara. I'm trained also as a neurologist, and I primarily am involved in neuroscience research focusing on Alzheimer's disease.
Before we jump right into your specific study, can you tell us what Alzheimer's is?
It's a neurodegenerative disease in which brain cells are dying for reasons that are not yet so clear to us, usually strikes people that are older, over 65 or 70, will gradually deteriorate in their cognition, in their thinking, in their memory, very often in their personality. It gets worse inexorably over maybe 5, 6, 7 years. Many people have had the unfortunate circumstance, I'm sure, of watching a family member go through this. It's very, very poignant.
And how about early onset Alzheimer's?
There is a form of Alzheimer's disease that we call early onset. And early onset disease is much less common than the older variety. By early onset, we mean getting the disease under age 65, but we see people getting it commonly in that group, which is a small group, but in that group, in their 50s, in their 40s, The youngest person I know of who developed Alzheimer's disease was in their 20s. That's exceptionally rare. But this group of young onset, early onset Alzheimer's, even though they constitute only maybe 1% of all the cases of Alzheimer's, are extremely informative for us from a research perspective.
What is the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia?
Many people ask the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia, and the answer is very simple. It's Alzheimer's disease is a type of dementia. Dementia, there are many causes of dementia, but Alzheimer's is the one specific cause. And the list is quite long. And if a person presents with memory trouble, thinking trouble, some other aspects of the disease, a good neurologist would go through all the possible causes of dementia to actually identify what that specific person's problem is. And most commonly, that problem turns out to be Alzheimer's, because Alzheimer's is the most common cause of dementia.
You and scientists from all over the world have been studying a large family in Colombia that has several generations of early onset Alzheimer's disease. Can you share a little about the family and the woman whose brain was just donated for research?
We have been studying this family in Colombia, a very large family that is in this category of early onset. Sometimes people have early onset and they're just isolated cases. We don't know why. But an even smaller subgroup within the early onset are people that have a strong family history and a genetic mutation causing the disease. I believe I mentioned earlier that for most people, especially elders, we don't have any idea what causes Alzheimer's yet. But in these families, we know precisely what causes it. It is a mutation in, well, there's one or two, three different genes that will lead to the disease in a very powerful manner. It becomes almost inescapable. And so there are several of these families around the world. As I mentioned, from a research perspective, they're extremely informative. And one of those families lives in Colombia. And that particular family happens to be the largest family in the world with this form of Alzheimer's, the early onset genetic familial Alzheimer's. And when I say the largest family, we're talking about a family of close to 6,000 people who many of them are, you know, fifth, sixth cousins. They don't necessarily know they're related, but we know they're related because the affected members of that family all carry the same rare mutation that is unique to that family.
And just recently, a woman from the family left her brain to science. She carries the gene, but did not have the disease. Is that right?
The woman that has come to our attention recently, discovered by some of my colleagues involved in this project, she has the same mutation that all, as I mentioned, all members of a large family, including this very special case. And of course, in any family, when you get a mutation like this, you inherit it from one parent. If your mother has it and you're unlucky, you might get her gene. If your father doesn't have it and you're lucky, you get his gene. So you get some genes from your mother and some from your father. And so there are people in this large family that were lucky enough to not inherit the mutant gene. And this woman, who was far beyond the age at which we expect to see people with the mutation get Alzheimer's, in this family, people get Alzheimer's at around age 45 or 50. And this woman did not have it. We thought she might not have the gene. But we like to sequence, when I say sequence, look at the DNA in all the members of the family. And it was a big surprise to find out that not only did she have the mutation, but she was not demented at all. She had none of the, did not have Alzheimer's.
This is Beth Thornton. I'm talking with UCSB neuroscientist Dr. Ken Kosek.
So immediately, she became of intense interest because our group thought that there must be some reason why she escaped what everybody else in the family was getting. She had the mutation, and yet she was not sick. So the first thing that was done was some of our colleagues from Colombia, a colleague of mine named Joseph Arboleda, and a woman named Yaquel Quiroz, took her to Boston, where they imaged her brain while she was still alive. And the first finding was quite remarkable. What they found was that she had only half the picture of Alzheimer's disease in her brain. Alzheimer's is made up of senile plaques and neurofibrillary tangles. That's what you see in the brain. That's the bad stuff causing the disease. And she had the plaques, but she did not have the tangles. That's remarkable because everybody with the disease gets both. Why would you only get half? And somehow, by having only one half of the problem in her brain, she was spared the dementia. So she became even more interesting. The same group went on and looked at her genes. And indeed, there was another very rare mutation, a good mutation. All mutation means is a change in your genes. It could be good or bad. And this was a good mutation in which a gene that is called APOE had a variant that looked for all the world like it was protecting her. It became even more interesting when, you know, just like I mentioned how you get this gene from any gene from your mother and your father, this patient inherited her Alzheimer gene from one parent. But in this case, the protective gene she got from both parents. What is absolutely mind-boggling about this case is how it was discovered. Here is a family in Colombia with a rare mutation to begin with. They're the only ones in the world with this mutation causing Alzheimer's. And then someone in the family shows up with an even more rare mutation that protects her. And then she gets it from both parents. So it's an absolute, you know, miracle to have been able to find this case.
And she lived to be 77, died from other causes.
Correct, correct. And so she recently died. And her family was very generous. They were willing to donate her brain to science and allow us to further work on the problem and try to figure out exactly what was going on.
How was the tissue allocated among research teams? It seems like everyone studying Alzheimer's would want access to this.
Yes. Well, we have a strong group of researchers working with this family for many years. The group is headed in Colombia by a neurologist named Francisco Lopera. And because we've been in this field for a long time, we are connected to most of the people in the field that are doing really cutting edge work. So it was not that hard to allocate the brain tissue to the people that had projects that could help.
Explain what your team at UCSB will be looking for.
The genes are encoded in the DNA. Every cell in your body has some DNA and makes these genes, whether they're mutant or not. And we have trillions of cells in our body. I mean, we have, you know, something like 86 billion brain cells, and we have, you know, cells all over the place. And every single one of them has 3 billion nucleotides. Those are the letters in the DNA that make up our genetic profiles. And when you look at the DNA, or how the DNA begins to make what's called RNA or protein, the way we just usually do it is you take a blood sample, you look at the person's, you know, all the DNA in the blood, or if a person has passed away, you may take a tissue sample and you look at all the DNA or what the DNA is making, the RNA, all collectively together. What we do is we can look at the DNA and the RNA, the product of the DNA, in every single cell individually. We can take from the brain, separate out the individual cells, and sequence the actual product of the DNA in every single individual one of them. So we can find out if there's a problem in this brain, we can figure out which cell type it's coming from.
This is a conversation with UCSB neuroscientist Dr. Ken Kosick about his Alzheimer's research. You're looking at changes on a cellular level.
That's the main point. These are looking at individual cellular changes of individual cells.
Is this a project that will be ongoing for years and years, or is this just a few months?
We'll have the answer to this in 6 months in terms of getting all the, you know, what we call sequencing done, figuring out what each one of these cells is making. We'll have that. The hard part about science often is interpreting your data. Because now when we have all this data, we have to figure out what it means. And that often requires a lot of statistics. It requires a lot of comparison groups and putting your results in some sort of context that makes sense biologically and statistically.
The Alzheimer's Association says 5 million Americans are living with the disease, and it's the sixth leading cause of death in the U.S. Is this partly due to the fact that we're living into our 80s and 90s?
Well, the large numbers that you quoted from the Alzheimer's Association, which does an excellent job, are in part due to the fact that, indeed, we are living longer, and the incidence of Alzheimer's disease goes up very rapidly as you get up into your 80s, 90s. But I think the other reason is because in the last decade, maybe a little more, we have also gotten a lot more conscious of the problem. We're much more aware of it. And physicians now have better tools for recognizing it and diagnosing it.
What are the best available treatments for the disease right now?
We don't have a treatment in the sense that we don't have a treatment in terms of anything that will modify this progression of the disease, the continuing worsening. All we have right now, and in fact, it's sad that we don't have anything because we've been working on it for a while, but it's a very difficult problem. And I have every confidence that we will find a way out. In fact, the only way we will find a way out is through research. But at the moment, the only thing we have are more symptomatic treatments. They're not great, but there are a few FDA-approved drugs that put a Band-Aid on the problem.
Do you anticipate any medical breakthroughs in the next decade?
I definitely anticipate medical breakthroughs because they happen. I mean, everybody, there's so much to learn and we have so many amazing tools to find stuff that the breakthroughs are going to come.
What, if anything, can individuals do to help fend this off?
What can people do to fend it off? Great question. There are some things that can be done, both medical things and lifestyle things. The medical things are three. Control your blood pressure, control your lipids, and you also want to control your sugar levels. And those are very easy to determine. So you just keep track of your numbers and know them. The behavioral things or the lifestyle things, the top of the list by far, the one for which the data is just unequivocal, is exercise. And people are really exercising from midlife onward, their likelihood of getting not just Alzheimer's, but a number of diseases actually is reduced. You know, having a good diet is important. Keeping your mind active is important in many ways, not just say doing a Sudoku or a crossword puzzles, but, you know, really talking to people, engaging in music or languages. It's important to get good rest, good night's sleep. These are all important contributors that we can probably do something about. They're not magic bullets. Doesn't mean you're not going to get it, but it can lower your risk.
That was UCSB neuroscientist Dr. Ken Kosick. The Central Coast chapter of the Alzheimer's Association has resources and information at alz.org/Central Coast. This is Beth Thornton for Issues and Ideas.
Working Lunch is a weekly Facebook Live production of the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce. Today, you'll get a deeper look at the work being done at Transitions Mental Health Association.
Welcome to Working Lunch. I'm Jim D'Antona, President and CEO of the SLO Chamber, and today you'll get to be a part of my conversation with the Executive Director of Transitions Mental Health Association, Jill Bolster-White. For more than 40 years, Transitions Mental Health has provided community-based mental health services and trauma-informed care spanning SLO and Northern Santa Barbara counties. Since 1992, Jill has led the team as they have expanded services, grown awareness, and supported tens of thousands of people in our region. Today, Transitions offers support to local youth and families, homeless services, housing, work training, and clinical care. So as we start, I like to kind of just get started at the beginning. Can you give us an idea of the scope of programs and support that Transition provides?
Sure. So we actually really try to meet a wide array of needs. So we have a pretty robust housing program. We found ourselves doing a little bit of housing development, but really providing permanent supported housing for folks with mental health diagnoses, intensive treatment. We have a whole robust family resources. So we try to support the family members who are sort of on a parallel journey. We've been moving more into providing homeless services where homelessness and mental health intersect. We do a Grand Grounds Farm as an example of one of our social enterprises. So we have a couple of small businesses. Their goal is to provide an employment entree for people to get back into the workforce. And a couple of other very intensive mental health services and a wide variety of support groups and wellness programs. So it's pretty wide range.
What has been the biggest change even pre-COVID to now that you're seeing?
I actually have to say it's been so universally positive from when I first started. So when I first started, mostly we wanted family members to sort of stay away from mental health treatment so the professionals could really provide that. It's really not taken too long, but that's a big change. Now family members have a parallel process. They participate when it makes sense for them in terms of the mental health treatment of maybe an adult child or a sibling. That's been a big change. Another one is sort of understanding more about what mental illnesses are, that they're treatable and recoverable. Again, that wasn't as much of an issue when I started in the 90s. I think it was sort of you have this lifelong disease was the thinking, and that you would really have to suffer from those symptoms in perpetuity. And so now we know people can really recover, that between medication and therapy and some of the other things. So those have really changed. And then a big change has been just people, the sort of elevating understanding of how important mental illness is. And that was happening before COVID. But I think people are learning more and more about what a big impact it has on your overall health and well-being. So those have been all great changes.
As you were looking at some of those new programs or ideas that were coming forward, is there one in particular that kind of you're most proud of?
Gosh, it's sort of like choosing your favorite child, as you can imagine. So I think I've been really proud of the fact that we are trying a couple things. I think our housing programs and developing housing in concert with HASLO, and we've gotten lots of support from People Self-Help Housing and really good partnerships.
What are maybe some of the biggest challenges facing those who need mental health care in our community?
COVID has certainly brought concerns about mental health. I know there's lots of national data. Centers for Disease Control talked about 4 times as many people reporting symptoms of depression and 3 times as many people reporting symptoms of anxiety. So we know that's true. And if we translate that locally, we definitely see an impact in our hotline calls and in outreach for family services. I think what we're really wanting to do is respond to what's happening now.
So through our hotline, which is a 24/7 service, we're offering brief therapy for the first time. So if somebody calls and it's really clear that they need that, because one of the big challenges is finding a therapist who has open spots, who takes insurance. Psychiatrists are very hard to come by. We are under inventoried for psychiatrists. Well, and actually, we don't look like we're under inventoried for psychiatrists because of the prison and the state hospitals. So when you're doing an analysis of the state, we look like the county has plenty of psychiatrists. The problem is there are not many who are in private practice. And so I've anecdotally experienced dozens of people reaching out, asking for therapist recommendations, psychiatrist recommendations, and even working with primary care folks who are being asked more and more. So we're just finding all those calls are increasing as people are realizing that, yeah, depression, anxiety, concern, the emotional upheavals of COVID and everything else are really impacting all of us. And I certainly can say in my own family, that's absolutely been the case.
I will share that same sentiment with you that, you know, from the family perspective, I wouldn't have thought that there was a shortage of services. But if you try to access some of those services, you immediately figure out that you have to go outside our community, which is obviously a huge challenge. And that was a challenge right before COVID even hit.
That's right. That is absolutely right. So yeah, broadening that array of services is one of my, is an important long-term goal for our community.
And so as, you know, obviously COVID restrictions are now in place and we've heard about how that obviously has impacted the health of children, adults, and certainly from, again, a family perspective, do you have local data on changes in our mental health? Is there anything in that has at least maybe from your organization where you've seen some changes in whether it's call volume or whatever?
Yes. So we have had spikes in our hotline calls. Last year, we took more than 10,000 calls, which was our highest call number. I know. So lots of calls. We have had spikes of up to 25% in that. Our family services team has had more reach out. So they actually served, I think it was 22% more than was originally, you know, we had originally targeted. So we're definitely seeing more. And of course, the big challenge is, like everybody in the world, is how do we reach folks? So for some of our clients, our mental health clients, it's trying to give them technology so they can access a Zoom support group. We had a really cool call out for donated smartphones and a really great group of Cal Poly students who helped get them all reconfigured and cleaned and scrubbed that we could give to folks who didn't have access to smartphone technology. So that was pretty awesome. And so it is. And then if somebody doesn't have that, we are trying to do some safely distanced in-person visits. So it's, you know, like everyone, the word pivot is just, I'm sure, gigantically overused, but I feel like that's what we've been trying to do to make sure nobody really suffers alone or in silence. And honestly, the hotline being a 24/7 resource is available for anyone at any point if they're feeling concerned, have questions, or even if they're in crisis and feeling suicidal. So it really is designed for that whole array of reach outs.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. The San Luis Obispo Chamber's Jim D'Antona is speaking with Jill Bolster-White of Transitions Mental Health Association.
So a little bit about the hotline. For folks who don't know, is that something that's for that you can call because you have concerns about someone, or it's more for someone directly who's experiencing crisis at that moment, or all of the above?
It's all of the above. So if I have a question about resources, if I'm saying, gosh, I'm just for the first time thinking about mental health care for myself or a loved one, the hotline can help navigate resources. And whether that's Transitions Mental Health Association or Community Counseling Center or CAPSLO or Family Care Network, we have a lot of great resources here. But it's also, so it's for questions, resources, if somebody just needs support, they're just, maybe they've been alone all day, they are really feeling isolated. It's a great way of just reaching out. We've added texting services because we know that young adults and teens text, so those hours are limited to sort of later afternoons. But we also know for some people sheltering in place, it's not confidential to make a phone call. And a texting is a quiet, confidential way that they can reach out. And then I mentioned that we've done a little bit of brief therapy. So we have some licensed therapist interns. And so if someone calls and it's clear they haven't been able to access a local therapist, we can give them a couple of free sessions with a therapist by phone and at least maybe get them to the next step. That may be enough for someone to feel like they've gotten things back on track, or then maybe they can find that next set of resources. So those are some of the ways we've tried to respond, but the hotline is a 24/7 resource for anyone who feels like they've got any sort of mental health need, question, crisis, or like I said, they're considering suicide for themselves or someone else.
And so thinking about it, one of the toughest parts, I know I share this with colleagues and friends, is, you know, how do you reach out to a friend or family that you might be concerned about or support them at this time? We talked about maybe calling the hotline, but are there other resources or recommendations you have for checking on or engaging without, you know, the hard part being, am I, you know, insulting them in doing this or bringing it more closely? Do you have thoughts on that?
Yes, it's so hard. I think a lot of us are reluctant to engage in that. Is that overreaching? Is that inappropriate? Like you said, will somebody be insulted or upset? We have been conducting mental health first aid for years now, and we're doing the classes via Zoom, so on our website. And what mental health first aid does is it's just like physical first aid. Teaches you a little bit about what mental illnesses are, gives you a description of clinical depression. Sometimes people want to know, am I clinically depressed? Or, you know, and of course, there is a whole gradation of mental health. And so it talks a little bit about mental health, but it also talks about initiating those conversations. How can I say to my friend who I haven't heard from in weeks, and last time I talked to her, she sounded pretty bad. How can I broach that discussion? And so I would encourage everybody to try to think about how to reach out. And if you're feeling concerned, then look up a mental health first aid class on our website. I know they're available and they're really helpful. If you don't feel comfortable about knowing enough about mental health or knowing how to even broach that conversation. But I would say 9 times out of 10, you know, an empathetic, caring reach out from someone who is caring makes a gigantic difference. I know when I've done that, or when people have reached out to me, I actually just had a friend who said, I tried to call you and text you, I haven't heard back, are you okay? And you know, it felt amazing to think that there's somebody out there who's thinking about how I'm doing. And so that's one thing I'd say that's been one of the couple of silver linings from COVID is I think there's more reaching out than ever before.
That's actually a great point. The pandemic has thrown a ton at us, right? Are there silver linings? Is that a silver lining that maybe you hope will become permanent as part of what, you know, what we do after COVID? There is an after COVID, I think. It's coming, I know.
I feel that there will be an after COVID. Absolutely. I think the silver lining is we acknowledge mental health has a big impact on our lives. And we acknowledge anxiety and depression may have been present for any of us who haven't experienced that in the past. So that is that's a normal, regular thing to talk about. And I would agree if people are reaching out. I know I have 2 sisters that I talk to very seldom before COVID. We have a weekly Zoom call. If that lasts, and if I think about friends who I don't see often, and I'm able to touch base with them, that's so good for our mental health. That's such an important connection point that we all should try to maintain as much as possible. So absolutely. And thinking about people who are in need, people who might have lost someone recently, people who've lost, you know, business connections, lost their business or lost their job. I mean, there are some very significant impacts to COVID. Those are the folks who I think can really benefit from a reach out, not only buying a gift certificate from them, but also how are you doing? How is this affecting you? Because that's certainly, it's almost impossible for it not to affect someone's mental health at that point.
So when you think of the future of transition, what do you hope the ultimate impact will be? What's your vision for mental health support and care in our region?
I would love to see a greater continuum of services. We've talked about some of those gaps, you know, that we work with partners to fill in those gaps. I'd love to see us do another round of, we did a Slow the Stigma campaign years ago. I'd love to kind of regenerate that and broaden it for the Central Coast and just continue to talk about mental health in a way that just continues to make it such a regular part of our vocabulary that we recognize it. We've had some great programs in the high schools in San Luis Obispo County to talk to kids. I would say my kids are 1,000 times more comfortable talking about mental health than I was when I was a high school student. They know so much more about it. I've been able to overhear some of their health classes. My daughter's a freshman. And that conversation didn't take place when I was a kid. So those are big. So I'd love to see that continue. And I just would love to see Transitions Mental Health Association continue to be turned to as a resource, whether we have the resource or we're giving, you know, passing along a referral to someone else. I want to continue to be a clearinghouse for those who need any kind of mental health support.
I agree 100%. As a family that, you know, has anxiety issues in our family, it was something that wasn't talked about early, but now we talk about it all the time. And it seems to deal with some of that. And I hope the same, that people become more comfortable with talking about it so that we can deal with it and, you know, try to find ways to get beyond it or through it or work with it. If someone is looking for mental health support, what's the best way to reach out to Transitions? I think you mentioned your, certainly we know the hotline, but also your website. Is that correct?
We do. We have a great website and it's www.t-mha.org. And it's got a lot of our support groups, access, contact information, and even some great mental health resources. And it would talk about when our next mental health first aid class is. I know we're doing a family services support group. We have a family services group for families who have loved ones in the court system. Sometimes untreated mental illness leads people into the court system. So I think we've got an upcoming class on that. We also, I would always encourage people who want to volunteer. The hotline is mostly staffed by volunteers. So it's also a great way to learn about all those mental health resources. If to be a volunteer, you go through a great training and you can sort of give it back if people are interested in wanting to be able to give back to the community in that way.
Actually, it was perfect. I was just about to ask that. So if people want to go a step further and support your work, what's the most impactful way someone could support your work, whether it's volunteer, funding, finance? Obviously, all those seem to be important issues.
We love volunteers. We've had volunteers do everything from a database of housing resources for us to, as I mentioned, the Cal Poly students who worked on those phones. But I think Hotline's lifeblood is volunteers. So that's really a great thing. Our Growing Grounds Nursery in SLO loves volunteers. It's great for a family. I have my teenagers volunteering out there. I think the other thing, I mean, this will sound very flippant, but you know, donating real estate. We are a housing organization. And if somebody had a house that, you know, had appreciated or they don't have a plan for it, we can use housing. Instead of an endowment as an organization, we try to use real estate because it's actually a way we can invest in our mission and it's used. It's not sitting there. It's really useful. And so to the extent we've been able to control our costs as we lease housing to our clients, that's made a big difference. So, and of course, always any kind of support, ambassadors in the mental health realm, it's great. And there is a donate button on our website if anyone is interested in that, right? But any way people can support us, including talking about mental health and helping just to be part of that conversation, that goes a long way too.
That was Jill Bolster-White of Transitions Mental Health Association, speaking with Jim D'Antona of the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce. Let's continue with our focus on mental health this week with the nonprofit story. We'll take a look at how the Gay and Lesbian Alliance, or GALA, has evolved on the Central Coast to be even more inclusive.
Welcome to the Nonprofit Story. This is Dr. Consuelo Mutes. Today I have Michelle Call, the Executive Director of the GALA Pride and Diversity Center in San Luis Obispo County. Welcome to the show, Michelle.
Thank you so much for having me, Consuelo.
Tell us a little bit about the Gaylor Pride and Diversity Center and how you came to be called that, because I know it used to just be Gaylor for a while, right?
That's right. So originally, we started in the 1980s as a group of gay and lesbians who really were fighting for their rights after when the AIDS crisis came in and those kinds of things. So we were called the Gay and Lesbian Alliance. We were actually incorporated as a 501c3 nonprofit in 1994. We held the first Pride celebration in San Luis Obispo in 1997. And then about 10 years ago, we moved to the current building that we have on Palm Street across from the courthouse.
Oh.
And that was amazing. That happened because of a donation that somebody left to us in their will. It was a really amazing thing. And so we continued along as the Gay and Lesbian Alliance for quite a while. But then as time went on, people realized that we wanted to be a more inclusive organization. So in 2018, when I became executive director, we held a town hall meeting then of our membership to kind of discuss how would this go? How could we be more inclusive? Did we want to change our name? Did we want to change how we did things? And the overwhelming consensus was yes. So we put together a governance committee with the help of spokes for nonprofits. We held a strategic planning meeting, and we changed our bylaws, and the bylaws passed to change the name to the Gaylor Pride and Diversity Center and a whole bunch of other updates. And so when that passed, that was actually at the beginning of 2020. So we spent 2020 putting together our policies and procedures and making sure the name change was legal and everything was correct, and working towards our new goals of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And we put together a new mission statement, which is the Gaylor Pride and Diversity Center supports and empowers people of all sexual orientations, gender identities, and expressions in order to support and unite our Central Coast community.
That's a lot of work in a short period of time. So now that you've become the Gaylor Pride and Diversity Center, how have your activities also expanded or changed in order to be more inclusive?
So we've definitely been working on that internally as a board, but also externally, we've been putting together some projects. We recently did a series called Authenticity, a Guide to Living Your Best Intersectional Life. And we brought together various people to speak their truths into the community. The most recent panel we had was on code switching. And it was really interesting to learn how people modify themselves just in order to accommodate white people. And so we realized that the diversity, equity, inclusion, in addition to including all kinds of sexual orientations, gender identities, and expressions, also is about disability, is about race, is about all the other things that come together to make us who we are. So that's just one of the changes we've been making, but we've also added additional groups. We set up a buddy system because COVID-19, of course, changed everything.
Right.
So we set up a system to support members of our community who are not doing as well by putting together buddies with people who need care. And really just a lot of work to make sure that we are supporting the people that need the help.
And so much thinking about the person as the individual and not forgetting people. Sometimes we start thinking of people as groups and that we always have the assets we need at all times, but we don't. You know, mentioning things like code switching, intersectionality, some of these really hard issues that we deal with, but we seldom have a chance to express are so important, which leads me to ask, what are some of the other major issues that your community is facing that we need to know more about?
So we're finding that especially among our young folk and our youth, which we've just restarted our youth program. Sometimes youth are finding it hard to connect because they may now be stuck in the house with a family who's not particularly supportive. It may be hard for them to even attend an online group or something like that. So these kinds of issues have really come to the forefront. And then we also know from the California Healthy Kids Survey and the Trevor Project, which is a national organization, just surveyed, it was, I think, 40,000 young people across the United States. So it's a really good sample size.
Yes.
And they discovered that mental health services, affirming mental health services, are really lacking. Mm. And people are having trouble really getting the help they need. And that's also something that the Q Cares needs assessment found locally.
This is Dr. Consuelo Mutes on the Nonprofit Story. I'm speaking with Michelle Call. She is the Executive Director of the Gala Pride and Diversity Center. Michelle, you're just talking about some of the issues that need to be addressed here in our particular area. You have so much going on. How are you actually set up to take care of this? In other words, are there professionals with a mental health background working with you or volunteers, or is this all staff run?
So thanks to amazing ongoing donation from Stoke the World Foundation, we've actually been able to bring on board Rocio Anaya, who is a bicultural, bilingual LGBTQ+ affirming therapist. And so she's working with us now. She has an office upstairs at our downtown center, and she's also started a transgender support group, a therapist-led transgender support group. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of things going on there, but that's just a small piece of the whole puzzle. Mm-hmm. And in a couple of years ago, SLO County Behavioral Health gave a grant to Dr. Jay Beta Garcia from Cal Poly to start the SLO Acceptance Project and the Q Cares Project. And that was a survey that was done widely in the county of San Luis Obispo to find out what the local needs are. Mm-hmm. And so now we know what LGBTQ+ people need with regards to mental health in the county. And then The second part was to train therapists. So she trained, Dr. Betty Garcia uses they pronouns, they, them. They trained a cohort of 25 therapists in the county in the first year, and all over the county in LGBTQ+ affirming therapy. Mm-hmm. And the second year, because of COVID-19 and because it all has moved on to a virtual format, they're actually able to train double the number this year who are currently going through the program. So while we found that there are some LGBTQ+ affirming therapists in the county, it's not something that's really given a great deal of attention during training to be a therapist. So people definitely do want that knowledge. And we're hoping that we'll be able to say in a couple of years, yes, you can go to any one of 60, 70 therapists and you know that you'll get good service.
With that, how many people do you actually serve each year within our county? And also, I guess that brings the question, are you just serving within San Luis Obispo County or outside of the county?
Technically, we serve the Central Coast. We do also have some folks in Santa Maria that we are in close contact with, although the House of Pride and Equality in Santa Maria really takes care of that population very well. So we probably serve about 300 different people throughout the year with our support groups and ongoing services. And then we have many more who will just call for a one-off. They'll call for a referral or they'll call for a piece of information. So for instance, if they want some assistance with name change documents because they're transgender, then we can send them to Trans Central Coast, which is a committee of the Gala Pride and Diversity Center. And Trans Central Coast can help them with all that information. Mm-hmm. And so if we're not a direct service organization apart from the therapist, but we can certainly help people get to whatever it is that they need. And we have a great many affirming community partners.
Are there other programs in addition to the ones that we've talked about that you have available?
Yes, so we have our body positive program, which we talked about a little bit, which was putting on those panels. But that's also, we do other things with that. We've done our fashion show and we ran a youth summer camp. We have our support group programs. Those are really important. We have our library, which is a 3,000 volume plus library of LGBTQ+ works. We're in the process of revamping that right now. Mm-hmm. And in fact, one of the goals that the board set for this year and the next couple of years is to be able to use that as a community space where potentially people could come and get a cup of Wi-Fi to go with their coffee and potentially have some mentoring with things like how to make a resume and other things that LGBTQ+ folks may not have received in their home environment due to coming out to their family or for other reasons.
So there's a comfortable place to come to, it sounds like, where people can feel safe and welcomed.
Absolutely. And then the other big program that we have is Pride. So we're going to be celebrating Pride 2021. And we're doing it in collaboration with Cal Poly's Pride Center. We have some amazing interns who are helping us put everything together this year, because of course it will be a different type of celebration than it's been in the past. Most of the things that we are offering will be virtual.
Okay.
Pride is an annual event. We had been doing it for 24 years in July. We've been doing Pride in the Plaza. But Cal Poly had said to us several times, the students are gone by then, and we'd really like the students to be involved in Pride, and we agree. So that's why we've moved it to May, and it's going to be May 17th to the 23rd this year. And we've got things going on, like there'll be a transgender night, there'll be a youth night, there's going to be a pet photo competition, Pride Pets. There's going to be a Pride's Got Talent. We've got all kinds of things to bring people together, a wonderful art show. Mm-hmm. And yeah, really Pride is a celebration of being proud to be LGBTQ+, being able to be ourselves, and really just celebrating our culture and where we've been, our history, and where we're going, what we're fighting for, all those kinds of things.
So it sounds like everybody's welcome.
Absolutely. Everybody is welcome.
So how would we find out more about your events?
Our website, www.galacc.org, has a lot of information on it. You can also send a note to email@galacc.org if you have individual questions. We have a newsletter that we send out monthly. And then on a Monday, we also send out what's going on this week. So those are great ways to find out what's going on. We're also on Facebook and Instagram.
Michelle, is there anything else that people in the community can know about to be more supportive for the LGBTQ community?
Well, that's a wonderful question. And I think that my easy answer to that right now is that there's going to be an LGBTQ+ town hall that we're putting on the 25th of February in association with Transitions Mental Health Association. Mm-hmm. We did an Out for Mental Health task force for 3 years in conjunction with the California LGBTQ+ Department of Health and Human Services. And that project is over now, but we want to continue on. So the task force has become a Slo County LGBTQ+ Mental Health Task Force. And what we're going to do is we're going to have this town hall where we're going to share with the public everything that's been going on. Dr. J. Betty Garcia is going to talk about the needs assessment they did and what recommendations came to County Behavioral Health out of that. We're going to talk about the strategic plan that we have for the next 3 years with the task force, and everybody will have an opportunity to weigh in. So it's really going to be a state of the LGBTQ+ community in San Luis Obispo.
Is this also an annual event that you do, the town hall?
No, this is a one-off, but if it goes well, I could see doing it on an annual basis. We would really love to have more people get involved, because the more people that know simple things like just announcing what pronouns you use, like saying, hi, my name is Michelle Cole and I use she and her pronouns, it lets somebody that might be gender expansive know that you're a safe person to come out to and to share their pronouns with. So there's just simple things like that that we want to get across to the public to help people really, like you were talking about earlier, we're all individuals and we all want to respect each other. And that's a sign of respect.
That's a wonderful point for you to give us, because I think people do have questions about how to be respectful, or you want to be respectful, and it's important to participate in some of your programs so that people can understand differences and how we are similar too. So, Michelle, thank you so much for joining us today on the Nonprofit Story. I don't know if there's anything else you want to just add. I could go on. I think we can go on for another 30 minutes and talk about some of the details of this. But the main thing is please join them at their website, and give us the website again so people can know where to go.
GalaCC.org. That's GalaCC.org. And, you know, we really welcome questions from anyone. We're going to be doing some community trainings, hopefully later in the year. We really just want anybody that might be in need to reach out to us.
So the community trainings, should we just go to the website and find out when they're scheduled? What type of trainings are you going to be able to give?
So these trainings are actually on a grant from the Community Foundation, the Growing Together Initiative, and we wanted to do them last year. We've been putting them off because it was really meant to be an in-person training, and because we're not able to give in-person trainings now, we got an extension, but we're realizing that that's really not, it may not be feasible anytime this year either, so we're looking to convert that to a virtual format. And so when we have that sorted and we have the dates, we'll be putting that up on our website and getting the word out to everyone. Our education committee is working right now, and it's lots of people from different organizations to make sure that our trainings are intersectional and really are helping people understand the bigger picture.
This is Dr. Consuelo Mukes on the Nonprofit Story. I've been talking to Michelle Call, Executive Director of the Gala Pride and Diversity Center.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.